Imagine it is 2 o'clock in the morning.
Okay, setting the scene. I like it.
Yeah, so a severe weather system has just completely stalled over your county. The wind is howling outside.
Oh, that is never a good
Oh,
situation.
it's terrifying. It's shaking the window panes, and then suddenly, the room just goes pitch black.
The grid tripped.
Exactly. The power grid is gone, and your immediate instinct, which we've all developed over the last, 2 decades, is to reach for your smartphone.
Right, because that's our lifeline for everything now.
Exactly. You tap the screen, maybe to check the local weather radar, or you want to text your family across town to see if they still have power.
But let me guess, no signal.
Yep. Instead of that comforting glow of notifications, you look at the top corner of your screen and you see that tiny ominous symbol, no service.
That is just a gut-wrenching feeling.
It really is. In that exact terrifying second, the whole illusion of our modern world just completely shatters.
It's a profound feeling of isolation, honestly. And most of us are entirely unprepared for it.
We really are. We just assume it's always going to be there.
Right, we treat the internet and cellular data like laws of physics, like gravity. We assume they will just always exist.
But they're not magic. It's all physical infrastructure, right?
Exactly. The entire modern communication network is this fragile, incredibly physical web.
Like it relies on thousands of cell towers.
Yes, towers that require constant electrical power
Yeah.
and massive fiber optic cables that are just buried in the dirt.
Cables that can be severed by what, a guy with a backhoe?
Pretty much. Or server farms miles away going offline. When the power grid drops, those cell tower battery backups, well, they only last a few hours.
Really, just a few hours.
Yeah, maybe a day if you were extremely lucky.
Yeah.
And once those batteries deplete, your $800 smartphone is, well, it's effectively a glass brick.
A very expensive glass brick. And when it stops working, you realize you are entirely dependent on a system that you do not own.
You don't own it, you don't control it.
And frankly, you do not even understand how it works.
Most people have no clue.
Right. So the moment that centralized corporate network fails, most neighborhoods are plunged right back into the 19th century.
But, and this is the important part, not everyone.
Not everyone, and that is the exact premise of our deep dive today.
I'm really excited to get into this one.
Me too. So we are looking at this really brilliant document. It's a club response profile dated July 20, 2026.
A very detailed document, too.
Extremely detailed. It outlines the inner workings of a group called the Washington County Amateur Radio Club.
Down in Texas, right?
Yes, in Texas. They go by WCARC for short. And okay, let's unpack this because we are not just talking about a group of people playing with walkie-talkies in the woods.
No, not at all. That's a huge misconception.
Right. What we are looking at here is an absolute masterclass in how a local decentralized community is actively building a resilient network.
An entirely off-grid communication network.
Yes, completely independent of the cellular grid.
This is a critical subject for anyone who actually cares about local resilience.
Because we are so dependent now, right?
Exactly. We live in an era where our dependence on centralized infrastructure is just at a historical peak.
Unprecedented.
Right. So what this document reveals is a grassroots group of about 75 individuals who just decided to take responsibility for their own connectivity.
They aren't waiting for the government or a tech company to save them.
No, they are building, they are maintaining, and they are funding their own independent infrastructure.
It really serves as a living blueprint, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. A blueprint for how communities can insulate themselves against the fragility of the modern world.
They are creating a localized safety net that operates entirely outside the systems that, the rest of us blindly rely on every day.
It's fascinating.
So to you, the listener, I want to say this directly. Whether you are a seasoned tech professional who spends all day in server architecture,
Or just someone who wants to understand how humans organize.
exactly, how human beings organize to protect their communities. There is a massive aha moment waiting for you in how WCARC structures their world.
But we should probably set the stage first, right?
Yes. Before we get to the antennas, the radio frequencies, and all the digital protocols, we have to start with the human foundation.
Because you can have all the titanium towers in the world.
And all the lithium batteries. But if you do not have the right people, the network is useless.
The technology is really just a multiplier of human intent.
I love that phrasing, a multiplier of human intent.
Yeah, I mean, if the community is fractured or just apathetic, that expensive hardware will just sit there and gather dust.
So to understand why this specific network works, we have to look at the geographical bedrock they're building on.
The cultural bedrock, too.
Right. Which brings us to Washington County, Texas. Now, for those who might need a quick refresher on Texas history.
Myself included, honestly.
Well, this is not just some random plot of land on a map. Washington County is literally known as the birthplace of Texas.
Oh, wow. That's a heavy title.
It really is. It is where the 1836 Texas Declaration of Independence was drafted and signed.
At Washington and the Brazos, right?
Exactly. And on top of carrying that immense historical weight, the county seat is Brenham.
Brenham, Texas.
Yes, which is famous for being the home of Bluebell Creameries.
Oh, ice cream.
Yes. And if you have spent any time in the South, you know that is an absolute cultural institution.
People are obsessed with it.
Totally. So it is an area that is just deeply steeped in a sense of place.
You know, what's fascinating here is how the source document explicitly connects that specific historical geography to the club's operational DNA.
How so? Like, how does history connect to radio?
Well, the authors make a deliberate point to note that this deep-seated sense of Texas history, this local pride, it directly fuels their culture of public service.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, it fuels their self-reliance.
Yeah.
This is a vital sociological point, really.
So they aren't just tech nerds hanging out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
These members do not view themselves merely as hobbyists. You just happen to share a zip code.
Right.
They view themselves as active stewards of a historically significant community.
So you are saying the history itself acts as a recruitment tool for civic duty.
Precisely. I mean, think about it. When a community has a strong shared identity, volunteerism stops feeling like a chore.
Right. It stops being, oh, I have to go to a meeting.
Yes. It starts feeling like an obligation to your neighbors.
If you feel a generational connection to the soil you are standing on, it changes everything.
Exactly. The idea of spending your weekends building an emergency radio network to protect that specific area makes perfect sense.
The geographic identity is the engine. It drives the technical ambition.
That's a great way to put it.
And that deep sense of taking care of your own backyard, it really shows when you look at their roster.
How many members did they have again?
They boast 75 members. And the document notes they are actively growing, too.
75 is a really solid number for a local club.
It is. And they are not just clustered in one affluent subdivision, either.
They're spread out.
Very spread out. The membership spans Brenham, Burton, Chapel Hill, Independence, and Washington.
Wow, that's a wide net.
They are stretching even into some neighboring counties. They are effectively casting a geographic net over the entire region.
Which is exactly what you want for a resilient communication system.
Right. But as I read through their demographics, I have to admit, I was caught completely off guard.
Why is that?
Because it completely shattered a stereotype I had in my head.
Oh, the classic amateur radio stereotype.
Let's put our cards on the table. When you hear the phrase amateur radio club, what is the immediate image that pops into your mind?
I mean, for the vast majority of the public, the stereotype is pretty clear.
What is it?
It's a group of retirees, mostly men, sitting in a wood-paneled basement somewhere.
Yes, exactly.
Adjusting dials on a dusty radio and complaining about their arthritis over a bed of static.
That is exactly the image. The perception is that it is an aging demographic.
A dying legacy hobby, essentially.
Right. Something being entirely eclipsed by smartphones and Discord servers.
But the data in this document says otherwise.
It paints a completely different picture. Out of their 75 members, 8 of them are under the age of 18.
Wow. Under 18?
Yes. That is over 10% of their roster consisting of youth members.
That is highly unusual for legacy tech hobbies.
They state very clearly that they have a massive commitment to introducing this technology to the next generation.
And they are putting their money where their mouth is, right? When it comes to the economics of joining.
Oh, absolutely. The way they structure their membership dues is, well, it's highly strategic.
It really merits a closer look because it's brilliant.
So an individual membership is $40 a year.
Which is already pretty reasonable.
Right. A family membership, meaning two or more members in the same household, is only $50 a year.
So just $10 more for the whole family?
Exactly. But here is the absolute kicker. For students up to the age of 25, they offer an associate membership.
And how much is that?
$10 for the entire year.
$10. That's incredible.
I want the listener to just think about that for a second. $10 for an entire year.
You cannot buy a decent fast food meal for $10 anymore.
No, but you can buy a year of access to a massive technical community.
If we connect this to the broader trends in technical hobbies, what WCRC is doing is mounting a deliberate defense against gatekeeping.
Gatekeeping is a huge problem in tech, isn't it?
Massive. In many specialized fields, whether it is aviation, coding boot camps, or high-end electronics, the financial barriers to entry have just skyrocketed.
It costs thousands just to get started in some of those.
Exactly. By dropping the youth barrier to $10 and keeping that family rate at 50, they are actively ensuring that institutional knowledge does not just age out of existence.
They are essentially turning the club into a multi-generational tech incubator.
That is a perfect way to frame it. An incubator.
Right.
They're sending a very clear message to the community. We care more about your participation than your wallet.
Which is so rare today.
It is. Imagine being a 15-year-old with just a passing interest in electrical engineering or, say, emergency management.
Okay.
Yeah. In most contexts, gaining hands-on mentorship from seasoned professionals would cost hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars.
You'd have to go to a specialized summer camp or something.
Exactly. But here, for a $10 bill, that teenager is suddenly rubbing shoulders with veteran radio operators, former first responders, and engineers.
It's an insane value.
The club is cultivating its own replacements, which, if you study organizations, is the ultimate test of long-term survival.
It creates this beautiful mentoring environment.
It really does.
You have kids who basically grew up tapping on iPads, and they are learning analog wave propagation from a guy who has been operating since the 1970s.
The knowledge transfer there is invaluable.
But, you know, having a highly motivated multi-generational roster spread across multiple towns is only half the battle.
True. Texas is huge.
Exactly. The physical distances are vast. If a storm wipes out the cellular network, how does that 15-year-old in Burton actually transmit a message to a veteran operator all the way over in Chapel Hill?
And that brings us directly to their infrastructure.
Yes. And I have to say, looking at the hardware ecosystem they have built, I was stunned by the complexity.
The engineering choices they have made regarding their repeater network are, frankly, incredibly sophisticated.
Why is that?
Largely because they have chosen not to abandon legacy technology, but rather to integrate it with the absolute cutting edge.
I want to list out the frequencies and modes they are running because it sounds like a technological buffet.
It really is a bit of everything.
Yeah. Then I want you to break down how this actually works for a listener who might not be a radio engineer.
Sounds like a plan.
Okay. So according to the document, WCARC operates a vast repeater network. In Brenham alone, they have a 145.390 megahertz repeater running analog FM.
Okay.
And that one is linked to something called the Crossroads Ham Radio Club.
Right. Expanding the footprint.
Then they also have a 147.260 megahertz repeater running analog FM and Yaesu System Fusion.
They have built a remarkably dense cluster just in that one single city.
And it continues. Still in Brenham, they operate a 442.275 megahertz repeater running something called DMR on color code 3.
That's the digital side.
Then they have a 443.250 megahertz repeater doing analog FM and fusion, but this one is linked to an All-Star hub node, 579140.
Very important piece of the puzzle, that All-Star node.
We will definitely get to that. Finally, pushing out to Somerville, they have a 444.825 megahertz repeater running analog and fusion.
It's a massive deployment.
Let's pump the brakes for a second, because that is a massive wall of jargon for anyone listening.
It is a lot of numbers and acronyms.
First of all, let's start basic. Why do they need repeaters at all?
That's the fundamental question.
Right. If two people have radios, why can't they just talk directly to each other?
To understand the necessity of a repeater, we really have to look at how radio waves behave at those specific frequencies.
Okay, so the 140s and the 440s.
Yes, those frequencies sit in the VHF, which is very high frequency, and UHF, or ultra high frequency, bands.
Okay, what does that mean practically for the average person?
Practically, it means these radio waves act very much like a beam of light from a flashlight.
Like a flashlight, okay.
They travel in a straight line. It's known as line of sight.
Meaning they can't bend around corners.
Exactly. If you are standing in a valley holding a little handheld radio, and you try to transmit to a friend in the next town over,
it won't work.
The radio waves will literally just smash into the side of the hill, or they'll be absorbed by the dense trees and buildings.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and even if it's flat, the curvature of the earth itself eventually blocks the signal. You just cannot transmit through miles of solid dirt and rock.
So how do you solve the line of sight problem if you need to talk across a county?
You build a repeater.
Okay, how does that work?
Imagine you want to shout a message to someone on the other side of a massive mountain, but your voice just cannot reach them.
Because of the rock in the way.
Right. Now imagine placing a person at the very peak of that mountain with a powerful set of binoculars and a massive megaphone.
Oh, I see where this is going.
You whisper your message up to the person on the peak. They hear it, and they instantly shout it down the other side at maximum volume.
Ah, so it repeats the signal from a highly advantageous vantage point.
Exactly. Well, to expand on that technical analogy, a repeater is an automated radio station.
So there isn't a guy with a megaphone?
Thankfully, no. It's hardware placed high up on a water tower, or maybe a commercial broadcast tower, or a tall building.
Somewhere with a great view.
Right. It listens on one specific frequency and simultaneously retransmits whatever it hears on a slightly different frequency at a much higher power output.
So it does both at the exact same time.
Yes. So instead of a little 5-watt handheld radio trying to punch through a forest, that small radio only needs to reach the repeater up on the tower.
And the tower handles the heavy lifting.
Precisely. The tower then blasts the signal across the entire county with 50 or 100 watts of power.
That makes perfect sense. That is how WCARC creates a blanket of coverage over Washington County.
The repeater is the high ground relay. It's essential infrastructure.
Okay, I follow that. But looking back at that list of repeaters I read off, they are running a dizzying mix of formats.
It is quite a mix.
Some are analog FM, some are Yaesu System Fusion, and one is DMR on Color Code 3.
Right.
Why build a network that is so fragmented? Why not just modernize entirely to one digital standard?
It does seem inefficient on paper, doesn't it?
Yeah, it feels like a city building a public highway and deciding to have, you know, one lane for horseback riders, one lane for classic cars, and one lane for autonomous electric vehicles.
That is a hilarious analogy, but it's actually pretty accurate.
Right. It just seems chaotic.
It seems counterintuitive at first glance, but that mixed mode approach is actually the absolute secret to their resilience.
How so?
Let's break down those formats. Analog FM is the traditional radio format. It is essentially the exact same technology used in standard FM broadcast radio or older police scanners.
Okay. Old school tech.
Yes. The advantage of analog FM is that it is universally accessible. The technology is incredibly cheap, it's ubiquitous, and it's simple to use.
Which, wait, that ties perfectly back to that $10 youth membership we discussed earlier.
Exactly. You connected the dots.
If a teenager scrapes together $20 to buy a cheap entry-level analog radio off the internet, they can immediately access the WCARC repeaters.
Instantly. No complicated programming required.
If the club had mandated an upgrade to a strict proprietary digital network, that kid would be locked out by a $400 paywall.
That is the inclusivity aspect in action. Analog ensures nobody's left behind due to budget constraints.
Okay, but then why have the digital stuff at all?
Because WCARC does not want to remain stagnant, which is why they also employ digital modes like DMR, which stands for Digital Mobile Radio, and Yaesu System Fusion.
I am curious about the difference in the actual user experience there. What does a digital radio signal actually do that analog cannot?
Think of analog FM like trying to hold a conversation across a crowded, really noisy room.
Okay.
The further away you get from the person, the more static and background noise creeps in.
Huh? Yeah. Until you can't hear them at all.
Until your voice fades entirely into the fuzz. Digital radio, on the other hand, does not transmit the raw audio wave like analog does.
What does it transmit?
It takes your voice.
Right.
Encodes it into computer data, literal zeros and ones, and transmits a digital packet.
So it is more like sending an email over the airwaves.
In a sense, yes. It's streaming data. The receiving radio takes those digital packets, decodes them, and reconstructs your voice perfectly.
Perfectly.
Because it is digital, it includes error correction. It completely eliminates static. It's either crystal clear or it drops entirely. There is no fuzzy middle ground.
That sounds amazing for emergency ops.
It is. Furthermore, digital modes like DMR allow you to split a single frequency into multiple time slots.
Meaning what, exactly?
Effectively letting two different conversations happen on the exact same frequency simultaneously without interfering with each other.
Oh, wow. So it doubles your capacity.
Exactly. It's highly efficient.
And what about that term color code 3 that the document mentioned regarding the DMR repeater? It sounds like a secret agent thing.
A color code in DMR is somewhat akin to a digital padlock or, say, a room number in a hotel.
Okay.
If a repeater is set to color code 3, your radio must be programmed to transmit color code 3 to access it.
So it's a security feature.
More of an organizational feature. It prevents a repeater from accidentally rebroadcasting signals from a distant digital system that happens to be on the same frequency during strange weather events.
Ah, I see. It keeps the digital traffic organized and local.
Precisely.
Okay, so we have the highly accessible analog layer for everyone and the crystal clear advanced digital layer for high efficiency.
Right.
But the piece of infrastructure that really caught my attention was the 443.250 repeater in Brenham.
Yes, the All-Star node.
Right. The document states it is linked to an All-Star hub, node 579140. How does an internet hub fit into an off-grid radio network? Doesn't that defeat the purpose?
It seems like a contradiction, but this is where local resilience interfaces with global reach.
Explain that.
All-Star is a system that links radio repeaters together using voice over internet protocol, or VoIP.
Like Skype or Zoom, but for radios.
Exactly. Essentially, the repeater receives a radio transmission from a local user out in Washington County, turns that audio into internet data, and sends it across the web to other All-Star nodes worldwide.
So if I am sitting in my truck in Brenham, Texas, talking on my local physical radio, that All-Star node can instantly route my voice to a repeater in Tokyo or London.
Assuming those nodes are connected, yes. Instantly.
Hey, that is mind-blowing.
While WCARC is fundamentally focused on building a localized safety net, the All-Star node acts as their escape hatch to the outside world.
Escape hatch. I like that. Give me a scenario where they'd use it.
Imagine the scenario where a localized disaster like a massive tornado or a regional grid failure completely overwhelms Washington County.
Okay, everything is down locally.
The local operators can still communicate with each other via the RF repeaters on battery power, but they might need to request specialized supplies from state agencies hours away.
Cell phones are dead.
Right. By keying up the All-Star linked repeater, they can pass emergency traffic out of the disaster zone to regions that are completely unaffected.
It's the ultimate communications Swiss Army knife.
It really is.
They have the analog layer for absolute accessibility, the digital layer for clarity and efficiency, and the internet-linked node for global reach.
A very complete infrastructure.
But here is the critical flaw with having an incredibly sophisticated Swiss Army knife.
Oh, what's the flaw?
If you leave it in a drawer for 5 years, when you finally need it, the hinges will be rusted shut and you will have forgotten which tool is which.
That is a very real danger.
Like, I can buy the most expensive fire extinguisher on the market, but if I have never physically pulled the pin or learned how to sweep the nozzle, I'm going to panic when my kitchen catches on fire.
Absolutely. Infrastructure is completely inert without human interaction.
It's just metal and plastic.
Exactly. A network requires a heartbeat. It requires rigorous, constant exercise to ensure the equipment functions and, more importantly, the operators know how to use it under stress.
Which perfectly transitions into how WCARS creates that heartbeat.
They are very disciplined about it.
They maintain a strict schedule of what they call nets. Now, for the listener who might not be familiar, an on-air net is essentially a scheduled gathering.
Like a conference call, basically.
Right. Operators tune to a specific frequency at a specific time and check in with a central coordinator.
And WCR's flagship event is their Sunday night net.
Yes. Every single Sunday at 7 p.m., they gather on that 443.250 megahertz repeater.
One with the All-Star link.
Exactly. The document notes they use this time for club news, announcements, and sharing information. But the statistic that made me do a complete double take was the attendance.
It's impressive.
They average approximately 40 check-ins for this net every Sunday.
Contextualizing that number against their total roster reveals something extraordinary.
Seriously.
They have 75 members total. Averaging 40 check-ins means that over half of their entire membership is synchronizing their personal schedules to sit down in front of a radio at the exact same time every single weekend.
Oh. I have worked in corporate environments where you cannot get a 50% response rate on a mandatory HR email.
Right. Let alone a voluntary hobby gathering on a Sunday evening.
It speaks volumes about the culture they have cultivated.
But the purpose of this net goes far beyond simply reading club announcements. The primary function is the development of critical muscle memory.
Muscle memory. Explain why that matters for radio.
Well, in a high-stress emergency situation, cognitive load spikes. You get tunnel vision.
People panic.
Exactly. You do not want a volunteer fumbling in the dark trying to remember which button changes the frequency or struggling to recall the proper etiquette for passing a formal emergency message to the Red Cross.
So it is all about the repetition.
Absolutely. By checking into the net every single week, the mechanics of operating the radio become second nature.
It just becomes instinct.
Yes. The operators learn the specific cadence of a directed net. They learn how to wait to be acknowledged by the net control station before speaking, so they don't talk over each other.
Which would be chaos in an emergency.
Exactly. They learn how to articulate their call sign, clearly, over a static-filled connection. And they're constantly testing their home antennas and their batteries.
So they know if their gear is broken before an actual storm hits.
Right. It builds a reliable cadence of operational readiness under the highly palatable guise of a weekly social catch-up.
And WCARC approaches this social aspect in layers, which I find brilliant.
What do you mean by layers?
Well, the 7 p.m. net is a formal, directed affair. It's strictly business. But the moment it concludes at 7:30 p.m., they transition seamlessly into an informal net on the same repeater.
A shift in tone.
Right. It averages about 10 check-ins. It's the radio equivalent of the meeting after the meeting. People can drop the formalities, ditch the strict rules, and just chat.
That's a great way to build camaraderie.
But the layers do not stop there. The document also highlights an HF high-frequency roundtable.
Okay, shifting to a totally different frequency band.
Yes, this one takes place on 3.953 megahertz lower sideband, and they do this at 7:30 p.m. on Sundays, Tuesdays, and Thursdays.
That is a very active schedule.
Let's peel back the technical layer here again. We talked about VHF and UHF being line of sight, like a flashlight. What is HF, and what does lower sideband mean?
High frequency, or HF, represents a completely different paradigm of physics compared to the local repeaters.
Different how?
HF radio waves have much longer wavelengths. Instead of punching straight through the atmosphere into space, like a VHF signal does.
Because VHF just goes in a straight line out to space.
Right. HF signals can actually interact with the Earth's ionosphere.
The ionosphere?
Yes, it's a layer of the upper atmosphere that gets heavily bombarded by solar radiation, which charges the particles.
So the signal bounces off the sky, is that what you're saying?
In simplified terms, yes. It is technically known as skywave propagation.
Skywave? That sounds very sci-fi.
It is incredible. When an operator in Texas transmits an HF signal, the wave travels up, refracts off the charged particles in the ionosphere, and basically bounces back down to Earth.
How far away?
It could land hundreds or even thousands of miles away.
Without a repeater.
Without any repeaters. Without the internet or any intermediate infrastructure whatsoever. Just radio, atmosphere, and physics.
That sounds like actual magic.
It feels like it sometimes.
But it also sounds like it must be wildly unpredictable depending on the weather in space.
It's entirely dependent on solar weather, sunspots, the time of day, and even the season. It requires a much deeper understanding of physics to utilize effectively than a simple local repeater.
And what about that term lower sideband? You mentioned it earlier.
Right. That refers to the modulation technique used to squeeze the signal onto the airwaves.
How does that work?
A standard AM radio signal, like you'd hear on a car radio, consists of a carrier wave in the middle and two mirrored sidebands carrying the audio.
Okay. So it takes up a lot of space.
Exactly. It's very wide. To save power and bandwidth, amateur radio operators basically strip away that center carrier wave and the upper sideband entirely.
So they only transmit half of it?
They transmit only the lower sideband. It sounds incredibly garbled, somewhat like Donald Duck if you listen on a normal AM radio.
But on a ham radio.
A specialized receiver can decode it back into a highly efficient long-distance voice transmission. It concentrates all the radio's power into a tiny slice of frequency.
That is fascinating. It is a highly technical, specialized mode of communication. But honestly, the club policy regarding this HF roundtable is what really caught my attention.
Oh, no. The attendance policy.
Yes. The source document explicitly states, and I quote, "All licensed operators are welcome to participate. Club membership is not required."
Right. It's open to everyone.
I want to pause here and look at this through a modern lens because the psychology seems completely backwards to me.
How so?
We live in a heavily gated digital world. We rely on private Discord servers, end-to-end encrypted group chats, invite-only Slack channels.
That is true. Privacy is the default expectation now.
Right. The societal trend is to lock down communication to a trusted inner circle. So why on earth is this club literally broadcasting their regular community hangout to anyone with a license who happens to spin the dial?
It highlights the fundamental philosophical divide between modern internet culture and the ethos of amateur radio.
Which is?
Internet culture prioritizes exclusivity and curation. Amateur radio, on the other hand, is governed by the open airwaves philosophy.
Open airwaves?
By definition, when you transmit an RF signal, you are speaking to the world. Anyone with an antenna can hear you. WCARC leans into this transparency rather than fighting it.
But aren't they worried about random people disrupting their club business? Trolls, basically.
The benefits vastly outweigh the risks of a few disruptors. By explicitly welcoming non-members into their HF roundtable, they are constantly expanding their web of contacts.
Expanding the safety net.
Exactly. They understand that if a catastrophic event occurs, crucial intelligence like road closures, weather updates, or resource availability, it might not come from someone on the WCARC roster.
Right. It might come from a completely unaffiliated operator sitting in a garage three counties over.
Precisely. By fostering a welcoming, open-door policy on the air, they are building goodwill and establishing a broader network of known, reliable operators long before a crisis ever happens.
It is the digital equivalent of leaving the porch light on and keeping a pot of coffee warm for any friendly traveler passing through.
It acts as an incredible recruitment tool as well, drawing in operators who might be looking for a community. And this open, welcoming philosophy on the airwaves perfectly mirrors their approach to physical face-to-face gatherings.
Because the technology is amazing, but the physical social events serve as the essential mortar holding all these technical bricks together.
Absolutely, the human element.
The document details a very robust physical social calendar. They host monthly breakfasts.
Everyone loves breakfast.
Yeah, and they hold their formal club meetings on the last Thursday of every month at the Washington County EMS facility, drawing about 30 attendees.
30 attendees is a great turnout.
They also host an annual eating meeting in June, and they throw a Christmas party in December.
Which is where the real enduring trust is forged.
That is a crucial point. You can chat with a disembodied voice on a radio for a decade, but looking someone in the eye, shaking their hand at the EMS facility, sharing a meal with them at the Christmas party.
It changes the dynamic entirely.
It elevates the relationship from a casual acquaintance to a trusted partner. And trust is the absolute currency of emergency response.
You can't function without it.
When the grid collapses and panic sets in, you need to know the character of the person on the other end of the radio.
You need to know they won't flake out when things get hard.
Right. All of this technical training, the repeaters, the nets, the breakfasts, it all culminates in their ultimate organizational purpose, which is preparing for the day the system fails.
This brings us to the operational edge of the club's mission, disaster response, and their interface with the government.
The document outlines their current focus on revitalizing their ARES program.
Right, ARES.
For the listener, ARES stands for Amateur Radio Emergency Service. According to the text, the club has an emergency coordinator named Ruben Fuentes, call sign WB5WTF.
So they have formal leadership for this.
They do. Apparently, local areas activity in the county went inactive sometime before 2020. But the club is currently experiencing a massive surge of renewed interest from the membership to rebuild this capability from the ground up.
Rebuilding an ARES program is a monumental undertaking.
What does it actually entail?
ARES is the official framework that transforms a group of, you know, well-intentioned hobbyists into a structured, deployable asset.
So it's not just showing up and hoping to help.
No, it involves standardizing training, understanding formal incident command systems used by FEMA, and establishing memorandums of understanding with local emergency management agencies, hospitals, and relief organizations.
It is the bridge between the amateur operator and the professional first responder.
Exactly. It's serious business.
I understand the theory behind ARES, but I have to play the skeptic here, based on a remarkably candid admission in the source document.
Who? What do they admit?
They are pouring all this effort into rebuilding ARES. They appointed an emergency coordinator. They run drills every Sunday. Yet the document flatly states that the club has, fortunately, never been called upon for an actual emergency communications activation.
Not once.
Not once. So, looking at this objectively, if no disaster has ever necessitated their deployment, is this entire apparatus just a giant, elaborate role play? Are they essentially just doomsday preppers playing in the woods?
I will strongly push back against that characterization.
Fair enough. Push back.
What you are articulating is a classic cognitive trap in emergency management. It's known as the preparedness paradox.
What preparedness paradox? Walk me through that.
It is a psychological phenomenon where the most effective preventative measures in emergency systems look completely unnecessary right up until the exact microsecond they save lives.
No, that makes sense.
Consider public health or infrastructure maintenance.
Yeah.
If a levee system holds back a flood perfectly, citizens will eventually complain about the taxes required to maintain the levee, arguing that it hasn't flooded in years, so we don't need it.
Right, because it's working so well you don't notice it.
The paradox is that the absence of a disaster is often proof that the preparedness is working. Or in WCA ARC's case, it is just a period of grace.
So you are saying their lack of past activation is not proof of irrelevance, it is just luck.
It is luck that they are utilizing brilliantly. Emergency communication is not a skill you can spontaneously invent during a crisis.
You can't just figure it out on the fly.
Definitely not. When a Category 4 hurricane wipes out the cellular backhaul, you cannot suddenly decide to consult a YouTube tutorial on how to rig a solar-powered HF radio station.
Because YouTube is down.
Exactly. You either possess the physical hardware and the ingrained knowledge to execute the deployment flawlessly in the dark and the rain, or you do not.
So WCARC views this quiet period not as a lack of purpose, but as a crucial training runway.
Yes. They're using the downtime to sharpen the axe.
And looking at their training schedule, they are not taking that runway for granted. They are not just sitting in air-conditioned classrooms discussing theory.
They're getting their hands dirty.
Yeah, very dirty. The document lists their participation in AROL Field Day, Winter Field Day, and Parks on the Air events. These are massive, practical, boots-on-the-ground exercises.
It is all about hauling equipment out into the elements, setting up temporary stations from scratch, and deploying field antennas into trees.
And perhaps most critically, operating entirely on emergency power.
That is the defining factor right there.
The power situation.
Yes. The transition from stable commercial grid power to austere emergency power is the crucible where unprepared operators fail.
Because it's hard to generate clean power in a field.
Very hard. It is one thing to plug a radio into a wall socket. It is an entirely different beast to understand the chemistry of lithium iron phosphate batteries, or the logistics of solar charge controllers.
Or keeping a generator running.
And how to suppress the electrical noise generated by a gas generator so it doesn't just drown out your radio receiver with static.
The source material details a very specific simulation they ran to test exactly these variables.
The field day exercise.
Yes, their most recent major training exercise was the annual AR Hour Field Day, which took place over the weekend of June 27th and 28th, 2026.
A huge event in the ham radio world.
But what stood out to me was not just what they did, but where they did it.
Where was it?
The Prairie Hill Volunteer Fire Department.
Oh, that's smart.
They hauled their gear to the fire station, set up temporary radio nodes, deployed field antennas, severed themselves from the grid, and spent 48 hours making contacts under conditions explicitly intended to simulate the total catastrophic loss of normal communications infrastructure.
The decision to host that exercise at the Prairie Hill Volunteer Fire Department is arguably the most brilliant strategic move in this entire document.
Why do you say that?
It is a masterclass in local civic integration.
Expound on that. Why is the location so pivotal?
Because amateur radio operators cannot operate in a vacuum during a disaster. If they're going to provide tangible value, they must seamlessly interoperate with professional first responders.
Right, they can't just be a rogue unit.
By choosing the fire department as the staging ground for a simulated grid collapse, WCARC accomplishes three massive objectives simultaneously.
Okay, what's the first one?
First, they are stress testing their RF equipment in a dense, real-world operational environment, competing with the electrical noise of the actual fire station.
Oh, because fire stations have a lot of their own radios and gear that could cause interference.
Exactly. Second, they're establishing a pre-vetted physical location to provide communications assistance to that specific department if an actual incident occurs.
They know where the outlets are, where to park, where to put the antennas.
Yes, and the third objective.
What is it?
They're building interpersonal equity with the fire crews.
Interpersonal equity, meaning trust.
Yes. Think about it from the perspective of a fire chief managing a chaotic disaster scene. If a random civilian shows up in the middle of a hurricane with a walkie-talkie offering to help, the chief is going to turn them away.
Because it's a huge liability.
Right. They don't know this guy. But if the chief needs communication support and sees the exact same WCARC volunteers who spent a sweltering weekend in June successfully running complex comms off car batteries in their parking lot, the dynamic changes entirely.
The competence has already been demonstrated.
Exactly. It replaces skepticism with trust. Furthermore, WCARC opens this field day exercise to the general public. They invite the community to come watch them work.
It serves as phenomenal public relations.
It shows the taxpayers exactly what this quiet group of volunteers is capable of when the cell towers inevitably go dark.
It bridges the gap between a niche hobby and a vital community asset. However, when you step back and look at the sheer scale of what they're accomplishing,
it's a lot of work.
It's massive. Managing 75 multi-generational members, maintaining 5 distinct repeater systems across different towns, running weekly nets with massive turnout, coordinating with fire departments for field days, and rebuilding an ARS program. The administrative burden must be staggering.
Volunteer organizations frequently collapse under the weight of their own administrative overhead.
I've seen it happen.
The logistical coordination required to maintain this tempo is immense.
Which is exactly why the final piece of this document completely surprised me. I was expecting to read about a massive bureaucratic committee structure.
Robert's Rules of Order, subcommittees, all of that.
Yes. I figured a club this steeped in tradition would have a heavy reliance on legacy admin, you know, a 20-page monthly printed newsletter, mailed out the minutes of the last meeting, formal parliamentary procedures, all the classic club busy work.
The exact kind of busy work that notoriously causes passionate volunteers to burn out and walk away.
Yes. But WCARC made a radically different choice. In a hobby deeply anchored in the past, they completely eliminated the traditional club newsletter.
Completely.
They do not publish one. At all.
That single operational choice speaks volumes about the health and focus of the organization's leadership.
Instead of a bloated newsletter, they rely on a highly streamlined email list where all members are subscribed.
Simple and effective.
This is their primary engine for pushing out weekly updates on club news, meeting times, and training schedules. They also maintain a modern website at w5am.radio, and they lean heavily on the on-air announcements during that Sunday night net we discussed earlier.
So they use the radio to do club business.
They have effectively stripped out every ounce of administrative fat.
If we look at the broader implications of this, you have an organization that utilizes the most foundational, robust, grid-independent analog technology for their core mission, emergency communication.
Right.
Yet when it comes to their internal administration, they are ruthlessly efficient, yeah, utilizing modern digital tools.
They don't let tradition get in the way of efficiency.
They recognize that spending 10 hours formatting a PDF newsletter that half the membership will just skim is a profound waste of human capital.
They know their audience, and more importantly, they respect their volunteers' time. They blast a quick email, update the webpage, and read the critical notes on the air.
Preventing volunteer burnout is paramount. By streamlining the administration, they ensure that the members' energy is preserved for the mission itself and for the fellowship of the club.
It keeps the barrier to entry low.
And they keep the activity fun. And honestly, nothing exemplifies this strategy of keeping rigorous training fun better than their utilization of the POTA program.
I am so glad you brought us back to POTA. The document mentions several parks on the air outings throughout the year.
It's a huge movement right now.
For the listener who is not deep into the amateur radio world, POTA is this incredibly popular international program where operators pack up portable gear, travel to state or national parks, set up temporary stations, and attempt to make as many contacts as possible with other operators around the world.
It is wildly popular.
And from a strategic training perspective, it is absolute genius.
Why do you say that?
Because POTA effectively masks rigorous, vital technical training as a highly enjoyable, low-stakes weekend social outing.
Let's break down why that is. Think about what you are actually physically doing during a POTA activation.
Okay, walk me through it.
You are packing a portable radio, a battery box, and an antenna into a vehicle. You are driving to a remote state park location, often a place that specifically lacks cellular service.
So you're already off the grid.
Yes. You have to evaluate the terrain, figure out how to safely launch a wire antenna 30 feet into a tree, tune it perfectly to match the radio, manage your limited battery consumption, and effectively communicate through atmospheric static to log contacts.
Which is the exact identical technical skill set required to deploy a rapid response emergency communications node in the aftermath of a localized disaster.
The mechanics are entirely interchangeable.
But instead of framing it as a grim, high-stress, doomsday readiness drill, they frame it as a fun afternoon in a beautiful park with friends.
It completely alters the psychology of the training.
It appeals to the seasoned engineering types who love the challenge of tweaking their portable antennas for maximum efficiency, but it also provides a totally approachable, low-stress environment for those 8 youth members to learn the ropes.
Exactly. If a teenager makes a mistake tuning an antenna at a park, it's just a learning moment.
If they make that mistake during a hurricane deployment, it's a critical failure.
POTA essentially gamifies survival skills.
It creates a culture of continuous deployment. This is the antidote to the rusty Swiss Army knife problem we discussed earlier.
If you only practice setting up your field gear once a year during field day, your skills will inevitably degrade.
You will forget which adapter goes to which cable.
But if you are heading out to a state park every other weekend because you're trying to earn a POTA award, or just because you enjoy being outdoors with your club members, your deployment times drastically drop.
Your troubleshooting skills become instinctive.
Your batteries are constantly cycled and tested for faults. You are perpetually ready.
So when we pull all of these threads together, what does this actually mean? We have explored their deep roots in Texas history, their aggressive efforts to recruit youth for $10.
The incredible redundancy of their mixed-mode repeater network.
Right. The disciplined cadence of their nets, their interface with local fire departments, and their brilliantly lean administration.
When you step back and look at the Washington County Amateur Radio Club as a complete entity, you are not just looking at a hobbyist group.
What are we looking at?
You're looking at an incredibly sophisticated blueprint for modern survival. They have perfectly synthesized the heritage of their county with both legacy analog hardware and future-facing digital technology.
They are far more than a social club. They function as a decentralized insurance policy for Washington County.
That is the perfect way to phrase it.
They are 75 distinct individuals who collectively represent the ultimate backup plan for their region. And the most beautiful part is that they are holding this massive capability together with $40 dues, a handful of repeaters on water towers, and an immense reservoir of community pride.
They prove definitively that a community does not need a multi-million dollar federal grant or a massive corporate tech infrastructure to build true resilience.
You just need a dedicated group of neighbors who are willing to put in the sweat equity, learn the underlying physics of communication, and show up on the frequency every single Sunday night at 7 p.m.
And that brings the core lesson directly home to you, the listener. We live in an age characterized by a fire hose of information and a hyper-dependence on an internet infrastructure that is infinitely more fragile than we like to admit.
It really is.
What studying a grassroots organization like WCAGRC teaches us is the irreplaceable value of maintaining analog connections in a digital world.
It highlights the critical importance of knowing the physical geography of where you live.
Understanding the physical layers of how your communication actually works, and most importantly, knowing the people who live around you.
True resilience cannot be bought in an app store. It is a human network you have to build by hand.
Well said.
And on that note, I want to leave you with a lingering thought to carry through your day. Imagine again that you wake up tomorrow morning and a major event has completely knocked out the power grid.
A total blackout.
Your cell phone screen says searching, and your high-speed Wi-Fi router is nothing more than a useless piece of plastic blinking in the dark.
It's a sobering thought.
In that moment of absolute deafening silence, do you actually know who in your neighborhood has a radio tower rising above their backyard?
Most people don't.
And more importantly, have you ever bothered to walk over and introduce yourself?